Good morning and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Hemant Gill. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is on the partial defense of provocation. Murder remains the most serious charge that anyone can face in the Canadian criminal justice system, with the highest possible sentence being life in prison. Given the gravity of the crime and its potential legal outcome, both aggravating and mitigating circumstances that surround the event in question become a matter of utmost importance in assessing culpability and punishment. Among the most controversial of such features is the defense of provocation under Section 232 of the Canadian Criminal Code, which reduces the charge of murder to manslaughter. The application and revision of this doctrine has been highly consequential in the prosecution and defense of Canadian murder cases. As a result, exploring the impact of this provision is a task of vital importance. My name is Hemant Gill, and I am a first-year student at Queen's Faculty of Law. For today's episode, I want to explore the provocation defense in Canada. In particular, the two key questions I want to answer are: what is the history and rationale of the provocation defense in Canada? Furthermore, whose interests does the existence of this defense serve and whose does it neglect? To help me answer these pressing questions, I have enlisted the help of Christopher Nowlan, a Vancouver-based criminal defense lawyer, instructor at the Criminal Justice Department of Langara College, and novelist. Professor Nowlan's 2018 article in the Canadian Criminal Law Review concerning reforms made in 2015 to the provocation defense was incredibly insightful, and the topics it explored were highly relevant in this podcast. I hope the following exchange will be as informative and interesting for you as it was for me. Welcome, Professor Nowlan, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me. So, the provocation defense has a long history, with its roots stretching back to medieval times. It sort of emerged from the idea that killings committed in the heat of the moment need to be distinguished from premeditated killing, with the latter being a more egregious act worthy of the label murder. The doctrine was clarified in 17th century English common law, which provided four categories of provocation: assault, an attack on one's family or friend, seeing another man wrongfully imprisoned, or catching your wife in an adulterous act. The 18th and 19th century further saw the incorporation of the idea that since anger interferes with one's ability to reason, it should diminish, though not fully remove, their moral responsibility for an act that was committed under its influence. I mention these facts not simply as trivia, although they are interesting, but because I think they provide important context for understanding the provocation defense. In your view, how important is it to consider these historical and traditional ideas about what constitutes provocation when discussing the modern-day provocation defense and its application?
I think it's very important still. I think it's very germane. The backdrop, the historical legal backdrop, I think is still highly relevant. I say that because, in my view, I still don't know what state of mind is supposed to justify the application of the provocation defense to murder. I still, where we are like today, this morning, I still don't quite know what the Canadian, legal authorities, legal world really imagines is what mentality, what state of mind is supposed to somehow justify, this this lighter treatment of the person who kills somebody in a so-called heat of passion or on the sudden. So I say that because I say that because when one considers kind of these historical rationales that you've mentioned, assault, attack one's family, catching your spouse in a an adulterous act, they still don't quite, they're still I still can't form a picture of why, like in and I hear what you're saying about how somehow anger might come into that, right? That there's this idea that somebody is angered by one of these situations. But I still don't quite I say that because from my understanding, Canadian law, as we sit here today, still has a difficulty accepting that anger actually can be a rationale for a successful provocation defense. And if anger is not supposed to be a mentality that is supposed to kind of, partly excuse the killing, then what is? Like that's what I mean when I'm saying I still don't actually know what mentality, what state of mind the Canada's criminal law is excusing for somebody who goes to my view great lengths to kill somebody. It's I think there's something that's odd to me about the thinking about this, as if there's something kind of like easy or to do like killing somebody is an extraordinary action. And to somehow imagine that, oh, somebody comes across a certain circumstance that, grievously upsets them, that they lose their control, and therefore they should be partially excused. I still just don't understand quite where we're at. And as we move along, I expect in our discussion this morning, I expect that we'll address this whole idea that the post Simard, reality, et cetera. So yeah, but that's what I mean when I say I just don't quite know to this moment where what state of mind Canadian criminal law imagines is somehow deserving, of some kind of partial or lesser culpability for the extraordinary act of killing somebody.
Right, maybe putting too much emphasis on the conduct of the victim in these circumstances. So, to move on, in the Canadian context, the provocation defense has been dealt with by the courts. So, in Taylor v. R. in 1947, the Supreme Court established the test for the provocation defense, whereby two questions had to be answered: whether the conduct in question would deprive an ordinary person of self-control, this being the objective test. And if that condition is satisfied, whether or not the accused acted due to that provocation, so the subjective test. Over the subsequent decades until 2015, the Canadian courts gradually clarified what could constitute provocation. In R. v. Tran in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled provocation defense would not apply in a situation where a man caught his estranged wife in a bed with another man, with Justice Charon taking special care to note that adultery and notions of personal honor could not, in and of themselves, be significant in the objective test for provocation. On the other hand, in your article, you have also noted that men who have killed women have been successful in some cases in using the partial defense. In 2015, however, there was an important change to the provocation paradigm. As part of the Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act, Section 232 of the Criminal Code was amended to define provocation as conduct that constituted an indictable offense that was punishable by 5 or more years of imprisonment. The stated rationale for this amendment was that it would prevent men from being able to use the defense in the event of a killing that was the result of some affront to their honor. Do you think that the pre-2015 status quo with respect to the application of this defense had serious issues that the reform was trying to counteract? And what do you think are the practical effects of this kind of reform?
I suspect that the 2015 reform, generally was meant to minimize the applicability of the provocation defense to men who killed their intimate partners and because of some perceived affront to their manhood. We can call it, I guess, the honor rationale or restoring their honor rationale, whatever, whatever. That's what I suspect the reform was expected to do, was to kind of dramatically minimize that possibility. And I expect that the reform, what its ultimate effect was, is that it probably made the provocation defense nearly impossible to raise successfully. To my mind, that would not have, I wouldn't have had a problem with that. Because as I intimated earlier, I'm still a bit confused for the basis of the provocation defense. So if in its own if it's in its own way, Parliament had by putting this precondition where the victim has to have committed this indictable serious indictable offense, by if by inserting that precondition, the provocation defense essentially became out of reach for anyone, for men and women alike, anyone. Then I don't really understand why that was a problem. But having said that, I don't know why Parliament simply didn't abolish the defense. Like, to me, it was a kind of a peculiar way of making a defense very, very inaccessible to anyone, as opposed to just outright making it inaccessible, like just literally repealing the defense.
Well, that status quo didn't seem to last very long because yet another curveball was thrown in 2019 when, in R.V. Simard, which you alluded to earlier, Justice Douglas Thompson of the British Columbia Supreme Court actually ruled that these reforms were unconstitutional. The case itself involved a man who shot and killed his ex-girlfriend and her boyfriend, and in the case, the accused brought a successful Section 7 challenge to those reforms. Notable about Justice Thompson's decision is that he argued on behalf of vulnerable groups, people of color and female victims of domestic abuse, both of whom may be able to kill their tormentors and be unable to use the defense so long as the immediate acts they were provoked by did not meet this high threshold. But I think all of this speaks to an important concern. In the context of intimate partner violence, which we've been talking about, it seems that the provocation defense has been used and continues to have the potential to be used by two very different groups: women who kill their abusive partners and men who kill their partners out of jealousy when they feel their honor has been slighted. So, how do you think the provocation defense has served either kind of defendant?
I guess the way that I would answer this question is by I guess by st beginning by saying I myself don't consider this reasoning. You alluded to it in terms of Justice Thompson's approach, to focus on vulnerable groups, etc. I don't find his reasoning, with great respect to him, convincing. As I see his reasoning, he has, for all practical purposes, I'm not suggesting this was his intent, but for all practical purposes, he really has restored the historic basis or rationale for the provocation defense to Canadian law. Like he's to me, he has, for all practical purposes, restored a kind of an affront to honor, that if I as an expression rationale. And if you want it, and if I can put it even a bit more, I don't mean to be glib, but he's kind of restored the hurt feelings rationale, because now it extends, like, right? If you want to follow my logic here, it extends now well beyond cuckolded men. It now extends to persons of color and marginalized persons who suffer, and I'm going to quote him now at paragraph 41, who suffer, quote, despicable and hateful rhetoric, unquote. That's his paragraph 41. And he's ex and similarly to extent would extend to women who suffer, quote, intense psychological abuse by their male partners, end of quote. Also paragraph 41 of his decision. But then he's careful to say that the verbal abuse or humiliation that would fall well short of a threat to life. And that's at paragraph 38, where he says it wouldn't extend to somebody not acting in self-defense. So I quote those are his expressions. And so by his logic, I'm suggesting the 2015 reform would deny the defense to a woman who stabs her verbally abusive husband to death in sudden passion when she is the 20 he in his log by his logic the 2015 reform would deny that defense to somebody who a woman who stabs her verbally abusive husband to death in a sudden passion when she is seeking to protect her dignity. And again, that's, if I get that right, that's his expression, her dignity. And I can't remember which paragraph that is. So you see, I'm emphasizing things like dignity, you know, like etc. And I think somewhere else he uses the word character, right? Because those words are getting very, very close to the idea of honor, okay, her feelings. So I would throw out there that this scenario that he considers is very much like the scenario that occurred in that Stone case, where Bert Stone got a manslaughter verdict. If I don't know if you can recall that case or not, but you know, generally speaking, Stone was verbally taunted by his wife. And then this idea is that a whooshing sensation came over him and he stabbed her to death fatally multiple times. Now he claimed to have acted as an automaton and to have been provoked. In any case, to my mind, this Simard reasoning has kind of confirmed or reconfirmed in effect is that a violent killing done by anyone in response to a psychological blow is partially justifiable, because that's what I feel that's what it seems to me are the scenarios, the hypothetical scenarios he's describing. Somebody who's a marginalized person or person of color who suffers, you know, absolutely, you know, egregious taunts, racial taunts, they could be sexist taunts, right? Well, nonetheless, what is being described there is a psychological blow. And if I understand this Samar decision correctly, Justice Thompson has said, well, in effect, there's a problem. There's a problem with the reform, because it effectively denies a provocation defense to people who have suffered that kind of injury. So again, I come back to this. I still don't know why we have this defense, but for much different reasons than Justice Thompson. Like what I'm suggesting to you is, it seems that Canadian law now seems to reject that hyperviolent behavior committed in sudden response to a psychological blow could be automatistic, because that's from Stone, and non-culpable. But when this behavior kills someone, Canadian law considers this behavior partly excusable as a matter of human frailty. We're back to this frailty thing. So we're back to where we started, I guess. Again, I'm talking even before like the 2015 reforms. So where are, I don't know that we're out of this old, you know, frailty, honor, you know, affront to dignity situation anymore, because of the nature by which Simard was reasoned, by the logic of it.
Right. I think what we're getting at is really the core of what the defense really is, rather than the rhetoric that surrounds it. And I think this transitions usefully into your article, your 2018 article on provocation, which went into great depth on the often difficult distinctions that the common law seems to draw between physical and moral involuntariness. So when applied to provocation, you noted that there really does not seem to be a functional distinction between provocation, a kind of moral involuntariness, from automatism caused by a psychological blow, which could be described as a form of physical involuntariness. So what does this spurious distinction, perhaps, in the common law tell us about the provocation defense?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'll try to answer the question. And it's not that I'm stuck on the Smart. I think the Smart's a nice point of reference, because there's some good history in there. But in terms of answering your question, you see, I take some of these scenarios that get canvassed in Samar that involve these similar kind of issues, different scenarios by which somebody, you know, putatively or ostensibly loses control. And I see them as morally voluntary, you know, and that's the kind of thing I discussed in my article, right? Is that, you know, somebody, whether it's a man or a woman who stabbed, say a woman who stabs her verbally abusive husband to death because of humiliating taunts, you know, or a person of color who endures heinous and violent slurs. Those are expressions that I've taken from Simard, you know, but not threats, right? He's careful again to not call them threats, because then we're getting close to self-defense, and we're trying to stay away here from any kind of idea that this has to do with anything self-defense, right? So I'm suggesting that in any of those cases, as egregious as they might be, the person who eventually kills, yeah, they could have easily walked away. They're morally voluntary. They're not a situation like we have in Ruzick, you know, the lady that decided, you know, to traffic narcotics across the ocean, right? Because of this, I believe it was a threat to her mother, right? We don't have these situations here. These people really can walk away. So they're not under duress. You know, there's no reasonable apprehension of fear. Again, I come back to this. So their feelings are deeply hurt. They're humiliated. You know, they feel some sense of dignity. But to me, they could, as a matter of moral voluntariness, they could walk away. So that's kind of, I don't know if that really answers your question, but those are the kind of issues I was trying to raise in my article, right? Is that we're back to this, this loss of control. I still have a difficulty with, in terms of, it's not in the scenarios that were put to Justice Thompson to kind of justify the unconstitutionality of this law. Every one of those involved a morally voluntary possibility of somebody simply walking away, calling the police, whatever it is. Don't get me wrong, they're walking away with hurt feelings. But now, tack on to that the possibility that instead of doing that, they go to the remarkably unusual efforts of killing somebody. They either happen to have a knife nearby, which is still going to be, or in, there's an actual scenario that Justice Thompson raises where the one person ends up beating the other person to death. Now, that is not an easy thing to do. So,
right.
So I'm just back to these are very morally voluntary decisions made by the killer.
Right. And just as a brief follow up, did you in your article you also discussed the idea of the whooshing sensation, the automatism from a psychological blow? I mean, do you think that that is a defense which is maybe distinct from having your honor slighted, or do you think it's just a kind of excuse?
I think where we get into there, like, because we end up technically getting into apples and oranges, because the whooshing sensation idea, which I think, no, I mean, that I don't know if that expression came up in the Raby case, you know, that preceded the Stone case, but it definitely came up in the Stone case, because I believe that was the actual evidence, right? But I believe that what happened following Stone was that the Supreme Court of Canada and then the legislature decides, like, well, we can't be letting men like this off who stab their estranged wife or stab their wife, you know, to stab it over a whooshing sound, over an insult, right? Over degrading comments, because that's what that was. Stone was degrading comments. It's not, that's what I'm suggesting. It's not terribly different from these scenarios put to Justice Thompson. But in that case, the whooshing sensation is meant to be a matter of absolute involuntariness, right? Like, of actually, it's meant to present the automatism defense for a full acquittal. So our law is, our courts and our law are now like, no, nobody's going to walk away with an acquittal from having a whooshing sensation, right? Because of an insult. So that's an acquittal based on automatism. But what we're at here now with, say, post-Simard, in terms of the reasoning in Simard, is we're now like, well, okay, you don't get to walk away from a whooshing sensation or losing one's control over insulting comments and degrading, but you may get partially, you partially get to walk away. You get manslaughter, not murder. And I'm simply, I mean, I think we're going to come to this. I'm simply still having difficulty with that. Like, what's the rationale for that? And it's probably going to be, the only rationale is going to be, is that there's this minimum, that there's a minimum life term, a minimum life sentence. And that's the only thing that I think remotely, intelligibly, and I'm not saying it does, I'm not saying I agree with it, but I mean, that's definitely going to be the response from the person who says, well, here's the reason why somebody who can react incredibly violently to a slight, you know, a degree, should not somehow be labeled a murder, is because we keep coming back to it, because of this perceived frailty. And I'm like, where's the frailty in this? How is somebody frail who, instead of walking away, decides to violently and with great difficulty kill someone? How is that frail? Anyways, you see where I'm coming from there.
No, definitely, yes. And you did allude to the topic of the next question, which is that well, the issue of provocation has proven to be controversial in the literature, but what I've noticed is that people who argue both for and against this defense do agree, or often agree, on something, which is a kind of problematic nature of having a mandatory life sentence for all murders. So, for example, you noted that in 2000, the National Association for Women and the Law recommended abolishing the provocation defense for some of the reasons we've been discussing, while also advocating the lifting of a mandatory life sentence for murder. Meanwhile, a 2019 Criminal Reports article, which was praising the Simard decision, but in it, criminal law scholar Don Stewart also argued that the provocation defense would likely not be needed if Canada simply lifted its mandatory penalty of life imprisonment for murder. Given this, does the existence of one of either the provocation defense or a reduction in the sentence for murder render the other obsolete?
Yes, I mean, I think so. So to maybe take it one step at a time, I think that if Canada lifted the mandatory minimum life sentence for murder, I could not see any justification at this point for the provocation defense, because I believe that if the rationale is going to be that there needs to be some scope, for ameliorating kind of scope for this so-called human frailty, then there you go. You've got it immediately. The minute a trial judge has sentencing discretion on a murder case, well, there you go. So that would literally solve that. I just I so 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 I guess where I'm coming from is I just simply don't see a link between provocation, because it's got this idea based on frailty, and I guess what I don't really understand is there are many offenses of violence, like in criminal law, like that are lesser than less that are less involve less consequences than a homicide, like in terms of assault causing bodily harm, aggravated assault, etc. And these are all violent acts. They're all committed in anger. A homicide's typically committed in anger. I mean, it's definitely a second degree murder. An intentional killing is committed in anger. There's no other way to get around that. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, violence is angry, and I don't really see where provocation kind of comes in to somehow excuse the person for killing somebody, except for this kind of theoretical idea. Well, we have a mandatory minimum life sentence. So for me, if the mandatory minimum life sentence for murder was going to be removed from the criminal code, I think it would have even more far-reaching implications that might be beneficial for the system in general. I guess I'm speculating a bit, but I believe that fewer people on trial for murder would actually go to trial. People charged with it, I mean, would actually go to trial.
Right.
As it stands, there's not a single downside for anybody on trial for murder to not go to trial. There's just absolutely no downside, because so if there were some flexibility in the potential outcome in terms of sentencing, we might see fewer people charged with murder go to trial for murder, and we might see more resources open up. We might see, less victims being kind of, having their victimization retried, that kind of thing. So I see potentially general benefits to abolishing the mandatory minimum, but and clearly one of them would be, I guess, you could get rid of the provocation defense. But again, that would just be something that came as something that would flow from it. But I don't see an intelligible connection between the two.
Right. Well, we've certainly covered quite a bit of ground today. I want to thank you again for agreeing to join me on this podcast to share your expertise. Just to close off, I wanted to ask you, was there anything in your personal or professional interest that drew you to this topic? And what's something surprising that you learned when writing your article?
I guess that I think I was motivated initially to write the article because I think and I can't remember exactly quite why, but generally what it was is I became interested in the way that Canadian courts, I guess, and criminal law regard causation, like causation in terms of what might lead somebody, for example, to commit a violent act, such as, killing somebody or what it might be. And so what I mean is I was interested in not so much the kind of what I guess we call the immediate causes, like for example, a provocative act, that leads somebody to kind of suddenly, suddenly take action in a violent way. But I was more interested in how what are the series of like what are the chains of events or the chains of causation that might actually get somebody in a predicament where they suddenly do have to commit a crime. So I'm thinking of the traditional ideas of necessity, the kind of the cliche of the mountaineer, the alpinist, that finds themselves, finds themselves on a
Right.
mountaintop. I was kind of interested in, is there any culpability kind of prior to that in terms of somebody not taking precautionary measures as a hiker, as a skier, that kind of thing. And I think, just to maybe give an example where one of those interests of mine got covered incidentally, like not fairly recently, was in that Brown case where the fellow, where the fellow became a self, took I believe mushrooms and alcohol, and then basically lost control, and was violent towards these women. And this was, I think, it came out of Calgary, and then the Supreme Court of Canada in that Brown case kind of commented on that very same idea, like shouldn't there be, isn't there culpability sometimes in some of the earlier decisions that people make that bring them, later on, to a point where it seems like they've got to do something desperate or they do something. So that was generally my interest. And I'm not too sure at this point what surprising came out, but except that once you start researching anything that you're interested in, you always learn new things and you learn new facts. So I'm sure there was moments in there where I was reading some of the old historic case law that was quite interesting. Yeah.
Well, with that, we draw the podcast to a close. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Yeah, you're most welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Before we end the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. The podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. Today's show was produced by students at PBSC. I'm your host, Heyman Gill. If you like this interview, you can find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website.